All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on the 6th day of April, 2021. And we want to thank each of you for making this show one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel, and thank you. And encourage you to send along whatever comments you have to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions and number 4, taylor@gmail.com. We do want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Today's sponsors are Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp., El Oro Resources, Irving Resources, Hannon Metals, Fury Gold Mines, Great Bear Resources, Lion One Metals, SK Mining Corp., and Firefox Gold. We have a very busy schedule, so let's jump right into today's show. Which I've titled Biden's Last Throw of the Geopolitical Dice. In the second half of today's show, Alistair MacLeod will talk about the background to the geopolitical situation facing the Biden administration and why he thinks America is destined to fail in the current Cold War against the combined power of Russia and China, not through a lack of military power, but due to economic forces. So we'll ask Alistair to explain his thesis on that. Now, if the global economy is going to turn green, there's a huge amount of copper and silver that will be required, and one mini-cap company with the backing of a major Japanese entity is Hannon Metals, with an enormous near-surface, high-grade, sedimentary-hosted target in Peru. Michael Hudson, the president of Hannon Metals, will be with me during the second segment today to give us an update on that company's progress. And then Michael Oliver, who he's not with us today, but he believes that we've likely seen the bottom in the bear market for gold and silver. He's not with us today, but another very astute observer of precious metals and a friend of mine who has had a great deal of success investing in the markets, in energy, and perhaps most of all in biotechs. That's my friend Chan Lin, and he's here. Michael's not here, but Chen's here, and we're so glad that he could be with us today. Thanks for joining me, Chen.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Thank you, Chen. And just to get your quick view on the precious metals, what are your thoughts now? Michael thinks we've probably seen the bottom. What are you thinking?
Yes. Gold is trying to bottom here. Okay, right now it's still very calm, so it's not like nothing very violent or anything. Mm-hmm. The gold needs to be over 750. To form some sort of double bottom, but GDX is already bottom. The chart looks like GDX is the bottom. So it's good, you know, and usually gold would, you know, one or the other, usually gold miners go first and then gold go next. It, you know, they usually go together. But we have seen GDX outperforming gold in the past 2 weeks, so which is, you know, very good, very encouraging. So, you know, we'll see. But the cloud is Goldman just put out a report. They think, you know, short dollar going to rebound here. They abandoned their shorting dollar. They have been shorting dollar for almost a year. They think because United States vaccine is rolled out so fast, Europe is so slow, so the U.S. dollar will have, advantage over Europe. Right, so that's the issue. It's possible. So we could consolidate as well. So it's a very interesting place for gold, definitely.
Yeah. Well, it's, as Michael Oliver has pointed out on this show many times, there's not that sort of correlation between the dollar and gold as a lot of people think. So sometimes it can actually move in opposite directions. But in any event, That's interesting, and well, we'll see, because you and I both have a lot of interest in seeing rising precious metals prices, and I think that you have also done some things with platinum. I think you sort of feel that platinum could outperform gold.
Well, for the time being, because the inventory are very lean. All the companies, they have a very, very lean inventory, and then when the demand pick up, they always have the, misplacement, not just platinum. The best performing metal is iridium, from 1,000 to 6,000 right now, just in 3 months. So it's like now it's back to work. Everybody wants to drive a car. Everybody wants to get a new laptop, new cell phone. Mm-hmm. All these electric components, it's demand going through the roof. Right, we have a chip shortage right now. So they couldn't have to shut down the assembly line. So there's a lot of issues. And what I feel, platinum is a significant discount to gold. Used to be twice as much as gold. So we have some room to go up from here.
Well, Chen, there's an emerging gold exploration story that you like a lot, and one that I've just added to my newsletter, Labrador Gold Corp. Talk about that, if you would, for a moment.
Yeah, I just have a very long chat with the management. I had an interview for the Metals Investment Forum. That's, I think, 2-3 weeks ago. So they just got a permit. Okay, they are drilling. And then they said in the interview, which published on the Metals Investment Forum website, that they are going to put the pictures on, because it's visible gold, okay? So if they see anything good, they're going to put a picture on their website so people know they hit the target. They're very similar to their neighbor, which is Newfound Gold. And structure-wise, if you talk to Dr. Quentin Henning, it's very similar, and then just on the border extended to their land. And then they already saw the very large visible gold on the surface, right? So they're just drilling, just trying to find a vein going under. So it seems to be a very high probability, and we're quite excited about that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I think they found some high-grade gold samples on surface, and I know that Quentin Henning talks about it being the same belt of rocks as the Queensway deposit next door there, that's Newfound Gold, and they're on to a tremendous discovery. He, he really compares it to that very rich gold deposit over in Australia that was really the company maker for Kirkland Lake. Well, Chen, I know that
I just want to mention that the Labrador Gold market cap is less than 1/10 of Newfound Gold. I think that's really the kicker, right? So that's
exactly right.
Very important.
That's exactly right. And Chen, I must say that I just recently, thinking in those terms, have just reduced my holdings a little bit of Newfound in order to buy some Labrador Gold. And I will be covering this story in my newsletter this weekend as well. Just with a couple of minutes left here yet, Chen, Amyris Inc. is a biotech story that is a very exciting story. Maybe just take 2 minutes and talk about Amyris, if you would.
Yeah, the Amyris is something I feel they have a strong potential. I was, when I was buying it late last year, I was trading close to cash, similar as I did with Apple like almost 20 years ago. So I missed Apple run, so too early, so I'm not going to sell this time. So I'm kind of holding. It has been tremendous run, and as it's turned, right? They started to cash flow positive. They just announced a major deal that put over $100 million in their pocket. So they no longer need to raise money. They have been raising money a lot in the past few years. That's why stock was so. Now they don't. They're cash flow positive. They are turning, and then they have over $100 million. They can monetize those, and then they continue to expand. The idea about that is using a yeast, genetic modified yeast, to produce anything you can think about in the world. So they can do from marijuana. If they are successful, their marijuana going to take over all the marijuana plants in the world, because they are so much efficient. They basically create marijuana on a cell level. They have those sugar cane, the sugar substitute. It will be much better and without any bitter taste. That's supposed to be the best. And then they have so many other things. They have squalene. Squalene is from shark liver, using your cosmetic. And then, you know, there are so many sharks was killed for this. Now that you don't need to kill the shark. They're from their yeast process. So they can, they have so many potentials. And I've seen company with, they're in their same area. Okay. They have 1 million, revenue. They're trading at a few billion market cap. This company has almost 200 million in revenue and trading at 5 billion. So it's like, relatively speaking, it's a hidden gem still, even at the current price.
Yeah, has gotten up to $22 or so, and I think you might have been buying some at around four, Chen. So congratulations on that. Certainly is a very exciting, I think, a new, really sort of a revolutionary chemistry company. I would sort of look at it that way.
Absolutely,
biochemistry.
There's a report come out that the United States competing with China. You mentioned a little bit that there are five areas. One is artificial intelligence. Another is bioengineering in this area. And they're the leader in this bioengineering. It's supposed to revolutionize the way, you know, for us in whatever, you know, in the future, for the next decades or if not centuries.
And it might have some implications for a greener globe as well. I mean, and I remember hearing one of the members of management saying, yeah, we could produce more cow meat and have fewer cows, something like that.
Exactly.
It's pretty crazy.
So many things is coming. Yeah. They have like a 20 molecule, and then they're creating, you know, a few molecules every year. It's an assembly line. They're like a few years ahead of competition. So this is like, hopefully the Google of this area.
Yeah, it could very well be the case. Chen, I want to thank you.
Their founder is also the founder of Amazon, Google, and Apple, Kleiner Perkins. So it's kind of
Kleiner Perkins is exactly right. There's some very serious people involved with this company, and so it's one that I've really gotten excited about as well, Chen. And you know, I'm such a gold bug; it's hard to pull me away from the gold sector. But this is one you've succeeded in getting me very excited about. I want to thanks, Chen. We do have to leave it go at that. My engineer is telling me we're out of time. We have to run now, but thank you so much for sharing your ideas. It's always a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate it.
All righty, folks. We do have to go to break now, but don't go away. Michael Hudson, the president of Hannon Metals, will be with me when we come back. Don't go away.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canadian exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable, high-grade gold assets across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Led by a management team of proven explorers and developers, Fury aims to generate major catalysts and performance per share by advancing exploration campaigns across Canada. Fury is well-positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under Fury. To learn more, go to FuryGoldMines.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again Michael Hudson. He is the CEO and chairman of Hannon Metals. Hannon Metals is a company that I've added to my newsletter. It's one that I'm very excited about because it has it seems to have tremendous scale and high-grade copper-silver sedimentary-hosted deposit. Well, I guess we can't call it a deposit yet, but certainly a target and very, very vast in a number of them in Peru. That Michael will talk about in a moment. Hannon Metals trades in Canada and in the U.S. You can buy it in Canada under HAN. You can buy it in the U.S. as well under the gray markets. About 83.6 million shares with some warrants recently coming in. Trading today, recently, in recent days, at around 47 cents in Canadian money, giving it a market cap of a little bit under $40 million. And that seems like a very modest market cap, given what I think this company may be able to achieve starting this year with some pretty serious exploration going on with COVID, hopefully getting around the COVID issues, and we'll see a more aggressive exploration program this year. So I'm really pleased that Michael could join me again. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
It's always a pleasure, Jay. Good morning from down under.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. On the other side of the earth. In your press release of March 9th, I noticed at the end you talked a little bit about the greening of this globe and how everybody is putting an emphasis on reducing the carbon footprint and wanting to get into electric transportation and so forth. How does that impact? I mean, it seems to me that should be pretty bullish for metals like copper and silver, which is what you're looking for in Peru. I guess those are the two metals you're primarily focused on there.
It is a huge overlay to the business. So, I mean, somewhere back in the 50s, I think the mining industry actually lost its way. Before the 50s, it was seen as a very noble industry, and people understood the direct link between economic growth and people's welfare and moving people out of poverty into the way that we're all now used to living. But somewhere in the 50s, I think, a generation or so ago, it lost its way. And I think this is a chance for mining to reclaim that mantle in many respects, because as everybody knows, not everyone articulates, if you want a low carbon world, you need more metals. And of course, there's so much discussion around sustainable and ethical supply of those metals. And with things like blockchain these days, where we can almost pinpoint atom by atom transactions, if you like, that's where it's heading, we'll be able to find and trace the metal coming from certain mines in the world in years to come. And there's huge studies happening right at the moment to do that, right through to that metal landing in an iPhone battery or a Tesla or whatever it may be. So there'll be different pricing around the metals, and we see that coming. And we already see that coming in terms of investors and their demand to see, a sustainable and appropriate ESG, environmental social governance platform to companies. And you can imagine an Apple or a Tesla just can't afford to buy metal from inappropriate places, whether it be environmental or high carbon issues or poor labor practices.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what you're saying is there's going to be more cognizance of those kind of wrongdoings or irresponsible mining practices, you think, and there will be a price to be paid, or at least a premium will be paid for socially acceptable means of producing these products.
Absolutely, they'll be differentiated, Jay, and it will start with the bigger companies and move its way down, just very much like our petroleum business has different categories and pricings around oil today, for example. For that is done because of qualities of oil. But oil has lots of different pricings, and copper only has one single price today. But that will change, and it's the way it's going. And as a consequence, metals will cost more because there'll be fewer sources of the metals that people want to buy, and they're becoming harder and scarcer. And I suppose that segues into the value of having very large scale projects at earlier stages right now will be worth a lot should they continue to succeed, like what we're doing, of course, in Peru.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. It's a sedimentary hosted copper silver target, a target, I guess, more than one. And you have something like 1,864 square kilometers, I believe. That's 186,400 hectares of granted mineral concession and applications in Peru. And that makes you one of the top 10 in-country exploration companies by by land area, by claim area. What vision do you have then for your project? I mean, give our listeners some sense of what you're thinking you may be able to accomplish, and to what extent do you think you'll be able to comply with, or the characteristics of your deposit or your targets, I should say, that might lend itself towards socially responsible mining?
It's a very big and broad question, Jay, and I suppose it's a plan that has been coming together over the last 2 to 2.5 years when we first went in back to Peru. I've had decades of experience in that country, but and love it dearly. But we went back in and said, where can we really make big discoveries? And you know, I suppose I got to the stage in my career that I had a few ideas on what really works. And early stage exploration isn't always rewarded, and the junior and capital markets will reward more advanced projects and legacy projects where people can perhaps come in and drill some good drill holes around something that's known. But legacy projects generally are legacy for one reason, that they haven't worked across a number of cycles. And what really turned my crank is maybe an Australianism, but what I really enjoy doing, what our team really enjoys doing, is making discoveries, and that's what motivates us. And making big ones is just as easy as making small ones in many ways, if you look with the right viewpoints. So we said, where can we get big land positions? Where are the big mineralized systems forming? And we knew a little bit about this area, which is the eastern side of the Andes. It's in the jungle. It's a harder area to explore from a logistical point of view, without a doubt. 20 years ago, it was almost impossible. I was going through there with a lot of security at the time, because it was an area that where a lot of the drugs were sourced for the world. But that cleaned up, and that really is not the case today. And we're going in there, and we've been working there for years without any real issues whatsoever. The major risk is slips and falling on rocks and hurting ourselves is the truth if you do a risk assessment today. So we made those decisions back a couple of years ago. Then we started to think about these different styles that haven't been found. And you mentioned that very big land package, 1,800 plus square kilometres, which puts us in the top 10 landholders. You can't make big discoveries without having big land positions, and the majors know that. So there's ourselves and Keith Barron and Urania who make up the top 10, and then the average market cap of the top 10 is something like $50 billion. So you can just see the major companies like taking big positions, and we're replicating that. And now we're looking for large mineralizing systems in Peru's new frontier areas, and it's two pronged. It is number one, this sediment hosted copper system, which is relatively new to Peru. This is a system that's known right from Colombia through Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, down to Chile, but nobody's really looked at these things in detail. There's some mines in Bolivia based on this mineralizing system, but these form big, vast mineralizing systems. The Kufa Schiefer in Poland extends through Poland and into northern Germany, and is collectively the largest silver producer on Earth even today, even though it's been mined since the Middle Ages, essentially. And really, they form generational scale projects, and that's what we found. We've got tenure over something like 120 kilometres, and it's tens of kilometres across that we're looking, and we're finding the right style of mineralisation, like a pancake, more or less thin but high grade over those kind of distances. And we were very fortunate to get JOGMEC. The Japanese government has an arm that looks to source metal for its industry, and we did a deal with them late last year where they can spend up to $35 million to earn 75% in this project over the next coming years. And over the next few years, we're even putting $7 million over the next 3 years into this. So we will have ramped up exploration as we come out and learn how to work with COVID. We were slowed down last year, and even this year we had February as a gap as Peru's numbers started to increase again. But we've been there working, and you'll see double the exploration dollars go into the ground this year than we than we spent last year, or actually three times as much, flying big airborne surveys and lots of teams on the ground and working up to permitting to drilling, which is very slow in Peru. So we don't see ourselves drilling until next year, early next year, but we've got a lot of work to do. So you know, a very large supporter. It's not costing Hannon shareholders a cent to participate in all this upside that is the San Martin project and a vast new style of mineralization that's really just starting to be understood by us and there's a lot of eyes on us and what we're doing. And then that's only one third, of course, of what we're doing in Hannon. Two thirds of that ground holding is in our own right so far, so not under joint venture. And we've made some very early stage discoveries a few hundred kilometres south of that joint venture with JOGMEC, looking for a very different style. They're copper gold porphyries. We're in an area that's seen very little exploration again, and we've had teams there for the last 4 or 5 months. We put out one press release earlier this month that I know has got lots of people in the industry talking and observing what we've got. It's very hard for your listeners to make an assessment between any company, I'm sure, and the results they're getting and beyond the headline numbers. Well, and then the headline numbers that we're finding up to 25% copper there. But the more impressive thing is the scale that we're finding high-grade copper and stream sediment samples, which are defining very large catchment areas. So it looks like we've locked and reloaded our exploration portfolio and going to do again what we've done over the last 18 months in San Martin and define a potential world-class terrain. So you've got two of those already in Hannon, one fully funded and one we're working up to look to do the same again.
So I guess this year it's going to be mostly surface work, getting ready, learning the geology, and then preparing for drilling in early 2022. That would be on your joint venture project. And what about some of those projects? I believe that some of your targets, and the two-thirds of the land mass that you hold, that some of those are, I mean, you mentioned there's a copper-gold porphyry target, but the others are mostly the sedimentary hosted copper-silver targets, much like your joint venture one?
So it's of the 1,800 square kilometres, a third is under joint venture with JOGMEC, which is a sediment-hosted system. Approximately 50% of the total land holding would be sediment-hosted copper, and 50% would be copper-gold porphyries. And I think just picking up on the different styles, the two styles produce pretty much 95% of the world's copper. Porphyries slightly outnumber sediment-hosted systems these days. But sediment-hosted systems are, in many respects, much more amenable to the modern world. And we touched on ESG at the start of this conversation. But high-grade systems, they're thin, but they form underground systems. So the average grades around the world of whatever commodity you're looking at are dropping, and that means we need to find bigger volumes of rock to mine the same metal generally. So, you know, back 15 or 20 years ago, it was a percent copper that was sort of the minimum position that we looked at for whatever style of deposit, and you know, that's almost halved. It's probably around to 0.6 now. Works gold is dropping in similar ways too, so people are mining bigger and bigger volumes of rock to get the same amount of metal, not more. And then the other thing to add to the mix is this growing population we have. We'll mine more copper in the next 20 years, and you've probably heard this one many times, than we have for the whole history of the earth. So we need more and more. We need to do it in more environmentally responsibly, and having high grade in underground mines where you have a much lower footprint feeds so well over vast areas, feeds so well into that dynamic. So it really is a style for the future as well, these sediment hosted systems.
So you're looking for a high grade underground and less of a footprint than you might have in some of the larger scale open pit mines.
Exactly, and we do have those porphyry targets, but you know, we may be looking at those. They could be deeper and they could be underground too, of course.
Sure.
But certainly the days of big open pits are coming harder and harder. to operate, I believe. And it's not the end, but there'll be specific areas where open pitting will just stop, and we'll feed into that ESG. And there's a term that your listeners probably have never heard. It's called project governance. And we know about board governance and making mm-hmm. sure boards operate appropriately, but it's a question that can be applied to a project itself and building a project that should be built as opposed to that can be built with all the overlay of ESG and social demands and political demands that are so much different these days.
So we're going to have to wait for drill results, the third dimension, so to speak, in early 2022. But it should be mentioned that you'll be having, I'm sure, news releases coming out from time to time. For example, this one that came out on the 9th of March. There's a lot of great information in there and exciting information, too. I mean, you talk about Zone East and Zone South, strike of over 2.5 kilometers, a structure that you found that's mineralized in some pretty impressive grades that are there on surface, I guess, right? These are outcrops.
Exactly, and outcrops are few and far between in the areas, but these were the first outcrops that we found over something like 2.5 kilometers strike of a system. We're seeing it, and it's open, and it's open in every direction, and we're only finding in two dimensions at surface and not at depth, of course, because these are surface sampling. But you'll see what 1 to 3 meters at various percents of copper that show this system can develop. You know, I think there's up to 6% copper there over significant widths, and it was 80 kilometers from the other outcrops that we found late last year. So it's the same system, and it's developing. So each release that you see will really be a groundbreaking one in terms of discovery, I think, in terms of what we're doing. We're doing a hell of a lot of stream sediment surveys over that vast area so we can start to pick the anomalous catchments to narrow down our search. We're just about to fly an industry-leading, I think, LIDAR survey, which is for those listeners who've got the iPhone 12, they know what a LIDAR camera is, because you can basically point your camera around a room or a chair, and it will image the chair or image the room to intimate points, and it's basically throwing out lots of laser points and receiving those back and measuring the distance between the camera and that point, and you can measure and map surfaces, and we can do that now with the increasing technology that's only relatively new over the last few years, fly these jungle areas and see the ground and map those outcrops without having to cut our way through thick forest, and then we can measure them and see where they're going, and that's got us really excited, because it will really shortcut our path to discovery too.
Wow. Technology certainly is playing a major role in exploration, development, and production in the mining sector. Michael, we'll have to leave it go at that. It's really, I think it's a really fascinating, promising story that people should be paying attention to. Your press releases will come out, and those people who are really able to perceive the magnitude of this thing, I think they want to pay close attention to what's going on. So I want to thank you very much for being with us and sharing this very exciting story with our listeners once again.
Thank you, Jay. This is one to play out over the next few years, but it's certainly the opportunity is vast, and we've even got the Japanese government seeing that.
Absolutely.
We look forward to talking to you again. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You bet. Thank you very much. Well, folks, don't go away, because Alistair McLeod is coming on right after the commercial break to talk about his recent article titled Biden's Last Throw of the Geopolitical Dice. You won't want to miss what Alistair has to say, so don't go away.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSXV and GTBAF on the OTCQX, is a gold exploration company focused on their district-scale Dixie Project in the renowned Red Lake Mining District of Ontario. Having made multiple high-grade near-surface gold discoveries, GBR's capital efficiency has allowed them to be fully funded to complete a very active 300,000-meter drill program through 2021. Stay up to date on what's been considered one of the best-performing exploration stocks in the last 3 years by visiting greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really happy to have with me once again Alistair MacLeod. He has a background as a stockbroker, a banker, an economist, and he's a senior fellow at the Gold Money Foundation and a head of research at Gold Money. And you should really look for his weekly missives that he writes. He's an essay, a serious thought about what is happening and why things are going the way they are in the markets. So he's writes every Thursday. It's one of those things I look forward to receiving in my inbox every Thursday. Or you go to goldmoney.com is the place you need to go to the Gold Money, the research page at Gold Money every week on Thursdays. Thank you for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
It's always good to have you with me, and I would like to have you comment a bit about your March 25th article titled Biden's Last Throw of the Geopolitical Dice. In providing an overview in that article, you stated, and I quote, "In a continuing Cold War, America is already on the back foot." So could you describe for us what you mean by America being on the back foot?
Well, I think America has been on the back foot for some time in the war, if you like, of the hegemons, if I can put it that way. You have America on one side and you have the partnership of Russia and China on the other. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that the founder of geopolitics was a chap called Halford Mackinder. And he wrote a paper for the Royal Geographic Society back in 1905, which posited that he who controls the world island controls the world. And his definition of the world island basically was between the Volga and the Yangtze River. Mm-hmm. This is a resource-rich area, and of course it's governed by a combination of Russia and China. And since they threw off the mantles of anti-capitalistic socialism, if mm-hmm. I can just put it that way, they have gradually been working together, building into a mutual power base based on, if you like, their sharing of the continent, their sharing of the world island, and Russia's very rich resources and her energy. And Russia is the largest exporter of energy in the world, even more than Saudi Arabia, because wow. You know, with Russia, we're also including natural gas as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're looking at a very powerful combination which governs really the vast majority of Asia. And on top of that, China has, over the last decade or two, extended her influence into the other part of the world island, which basically is Africa. Mm-hmm. And she now controls Africa. In anywhere you go in Africa. And I remember I was doing some business in Zambia, and they've got a rather antiquated telephone system. I called someone in the capital there, and got an all lines of busy message in English, and then the same message, not in Chinyanga, which is the local language, not in French, but in Chinese. And that just tells you all you need to know. Because, of course, Zambia used to be northern Rhodesia. And, of course, they've got the copper mines up there in the north, which are of great interest to China. So you can see why China has extended her interests in those directions. And the other thing is that, of course, she's built the Twin Silk Roads. There's the overland. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean... For example, Zanussi, which is a white goods manufacturer in Italy, has stuff manufactured in its factories or, if you like, sort of under contract in China. It's then put into these containers and comes over by rail, and it's delivered literally within a week, rather than having to go all the way around, the sort of the sea routes. Mm-hmm. So, and the sea routes are also important, and spurs off it, joining up with the Silk Road itself, bringing mm-hmm. in Iran. I mean, Iran is the third member, the third serious member of this evolving situation. So what we're looking at, if you're taking the whole of the world island, we are looking at a bare majority of the world's population, basically out of the influence of the US dollar. And this is a very serious situation, because while international trade is still mainly US dollar, and certainly the purchase of all commodities are done internationally, mm-hmm. priced in US dollars, you can see how you've got this sleeping giant there who actually is sort of semi-detached to the dollar. And not only that, but has ambitions to use its own currencies in the fullness of time. They have been very smart about the way they have run things. And we saw this particularly under President Trump, because at virtually every provocation from the Americans, the Chinese and the Russians did not respond. Mm-hmm. Anything they did was very quiet. It was out of the headlines. I mean, for example, the attempt to destabilize Syria. I mean, the Russians were there as well, and they were giving covert support to the Syrian government, along with the Turks. So you can see that. In that situation, I mean, America was on the back foot. And I think one of the sensible things that President Trump did was try and disengage from that theater. But of course, he was prevented from doing so because this was not a policy which was acceptable to Langley. I mean, Langley basically, I think, has a huge influence on the president when it comes to geopolitics. I mean, this is happens when you get a permanent establishment. Mm-hmm. It's very, very hard to run against it. So that was a big, big problem. Anyway, the whole point of it is that China and Russia between them now have probably more economic power than America. And the problem is that America, I mean, I think people in the administration, you know, the sort of the people who, are the sort of long-time staffers, do actually understand this problem. They know that they're fighting a difficult battle, and they think they're trying to stop the slide. But I think there are others in the Biden administration who actually, I hope it wouldn't be too offensive, but I would say they're a bit wet behind the ears when it comes to these issues. Now, Biden himself, of course, has had a long history of involvement with foreign affairs, being on, committees and all the rest of it. So I think that he does have some knowledge of what is involved, but it's very much, I think, in the Langley mold. I would expect Langley to take the view that from their point of view, President Biden is a safe pair of hands, which basically means that he will continue doing what Langley wants.
And what the Obama administration basically carried out before Trump, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. An extension of that, yeah.
So what we're talking about here is this rising competition between the hegemons, the yes. U.S. on the one hand, and the Chinese and Russians coming together on the other. You have this massive amount of natural resources, energy, as you say. Russia is the largest energy producer. Of course, if you're saying Iran is part of this serious... and they are an energy giant as well. Clearly, China needs energy. At the same time, the United States and the West is talking about going green and using windmills. China is very serious about securing its petrol, I guess, isn't it? It understands that you need that in order to be a rising power and for prosperity, frankly.
Yes, exactly that. And I mean, certainly, I think perhaps part of the sort of unwritten strategy from the West about oil is they see that Russia is now the largest exporter. Mm-hmm. And there is no doubt that Saudi Arabia is drifting out of the American sphere of influence. I mean, she doesn't supply any oil to America for a start. And there's another interesting point, because I interviewed a director of one of the Swiss refiners, I think back in 2014. Mm-hmm. And they were incredibly busy. And one of the things they were doing is they were taking gold in LBMA bars out of Arab ownership and recasting them into kilo bars, the Chinese standard, 4.9s. And returning them to the owners, or, you know, the owners' vaulting arrangements, which is interesting, because that clearly shows that the strategic thinking in the Middle East is very much that the future is, if you like, Halford Mackinder's World Island, not America. And this matters because I think from an American point of view, and I think from Biden's point of view, sort of very much a change from the way Trump looked at it. One thing which does make sense is to remove the power that Russia, Iran, Middle East has over energy by promoting the decarbonization of fuel. And this is why I think that it makes certainly sense for Europe, if you like. It makes sense of their pursuit of trying to reduce dependency on fossil fuels.
Well, that's it's certainly not limitless. That's for sure, and it's getting harder and harder to find and produce oil from. So that's a reality for sure. Where does that leave then, Alistair? Maybe you can just point out where that leaves North and South America, Britain and Japan and Australia. Some of those that aren't included in that, in that area that Halford Mackinder is talking about.
Yes. What I did in that article is that I described quite a few of the nations in the continents that you mentioned as fence sitters. I mean, I certainly knew this in Africa, because you would find that local politicians, you know, would take money off whoever was giving him most money. And, you know, it would end up going into his Swiss bank account. Things are different now. I mean, last time I went to Grenada, which was, what, about 4 years ago, the Chinese were building a bridge for the government in Grenada. You know, and it was financed by the Chinese. It was staffed by Chinese, you know, sort of civil engineers and so on. And some of the locals were employed on it. I mean, it's a very different thing. The way the Chinese do things is that they try and control the whole project. And this is very different from the sort of hegemony approach of the Americans in the past, who have, you know, either sort of, you know, chucked money in under the pretense of some sort of scheme. There would have been World Bank supervision, or African Development Bank supervision, or something like that. And I think the fence sitters nowadays are very much in Latin America. I mean, look at Chile. She exports so much copper ore, and silver ore, and lithium to China. I mean, so you know, these trade links are there, and it's also true of Brazil too. And of course, you know, they have conferences which you know are sort of the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the BRICS. You know, so that is a separate movement. But you can see how the Russian and Chinese partnerships' tentacles are really stretching around the world. And the only really firm allies, I think, that America has of any significance are the Five Eyes partnership, which basically is Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, you know, along with the US. Right. And you know, you can see this. You can see this in the relationship between Australia and China. I mean, they're at the moment having huge, great trade spats. They really are. And why is this? the reason for it is that Australia is very, very firmly in that Five Eyes American camp. But this is the problem. I mean, if you look at the populations of the Five Eyes, I mean, you've got the US itself, which is what, you're 328 million. You've got Canada, which is another 30 million or something. You've got Australia, another 30 million. You've got New Zealand, which is about 8 million. And you've got us, we're about 60. Now, in terms of numbers, we're up against over half the world's population. So, while we've got the military power, and this is another point I made in the article, military power, yes, we've got a lot of military power, and there's no way that we're going to have a military conflict because of that. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, we're losing the economic power. I mean, we've traduced our own economies to such an extent, while China in particular has continued to build hers, that we're just losing out. We're losing out because we are mishandling our economies. And this is such a serious point, which I don't think anyone really talks about, but they should talk about. Because if you're really serious about retaining world power for whatever reasons, then you've got to have an economy which allows you to deliver what is necessary to retain that power.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess then what I'm hearing you say is Europe would be drifting towards the Chinese sphere as well. They would be part of that Mackinder's area that he's talking about.
Yes. I mean, obviously not directly, but you will be aware that there's the Nord Stream project. Which is a joint project between Russia and Germany. And the idea of that from the Russian point of view is basically to cut the Ukraine out of the transitional pipeline, as it were, which goes across their territory and which they collect fees. And the Ukraine has been a poor payer to Russia in the past. So, there is a sort of mini geopolitical thing there. And remember also that the terminal of the overland Silk Road is, in Europe. And it's got, you can put your, a Mercedes car on the train in Stuttgart and it's in the showroom, 8 days later. Bam, just like that. And this is this. So the ties between China, Russia, and Europe are increasing all the time on a trade basis, not so much on a political basis. But remember also that the EU is trying to build its own separate army, if you like, so that it is no longer, just sort of dominated by NATO, which is dominated by America and, Britain to a lesser extent. They're trying to go their own way militarily. And I think that to me also indicates that they are seeking to move away from the influence of America more and more. And now that Britain is not in the EU, it's going to be a lot easier for them to do that, because I think that we would have been regarded by America, and we would certainly regard ourselves as being very much that Five Eyes relationship, the special relationship with America. We were America's representative in a sense in Brussels. Sure. Europe, you're absolutely right. That I think I would describe as a modern version of the African fence sitters. It's on trade rather than bribery with more money than the Russians were prepared to give.
Well, Alistair, it seems as though America thinks that it can depend on its military. It doesn't seem to make the connection about its indebtedness and its loss of financial superiority. And it sort of thinks they don't see the connection. Americans tend not to see the connection between our fiscal irresponsibility or our decline economically with military strength. It seems to me at some point in time, a declining economy is going to affect an ability to maintain a military and retain even the military power.
In theory, I think you're right. But there is a tendency, I think, for any government, and I hate to say this, but to put its own military ahead of its own people. Mm-hmm. So the US economy can continue to run down and maintain a military, I think, for some considerable time. It's really because of where the you know, the sort of the politicians' priorities are rather than the priorities of the people. And of course, defense is the most important thing. I mean, if you've got a problem at home, start a war abroad. You know? And the people at home will be behind you. That's very crude. It's a very crude statement, but you can sort of see the sort of reasoning which we've seen so often in American presidents.
Yeah, Wag the Dog, it was called. I think there was a movie after that even. In any event, this whole idea that we have had, the dollar has been supported by the petrodollar. It has become the petrodollar, as you know, after after Nixon disconnected gold from money in 1971, with Saudi Arabia migrating towards the Chinese sphere then, what does that do to the petrodollar?
Well, the petrodollar really is, I mean, in that sense, has gone. I mean, what you were talking about really is, you know, you had these huge, great monetary surpluses building up in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia in particular came to an agreement with Kissinger and Nixon that they would take payment in dollars, deposit the dollars in the U.S. banks, and then the U.S. banks could lend that money out to Latin America. And of course, we know what happened Latin America in the late 70s. So, you know, that roundabout stopped a long time ago. What we now have, I think, is really a rather delicate balance. China understands the weaknesses of the American position and also the weaknesses of the EU position. I mean, that, you know, you don't have to be a genius to see see just how, you know, you've got a failing state. It's not a failing state, but it's a collection of states under a failing umbrella, if you like, of the European Commission. Now, these are very, very serious events, and I don't think that the China-Russia partnership would want to be, I mean, particularly the Chinese, I think the Russians care slightly less about this, but the Chinese don't want to be seen as setting off a catastrophe in the West. Mm-hmm. So I don't see them taking moves, if you like, to destabilize the dollar or to destabilize the euro. If anything, I think it'd be very careful to try and ensure that these major currencies are not destabilized. And I think they would rather find a more evolutionary way of you know, expanding their control over what's called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. 21 states of, you know, members and associates and all the rest of it. And I think by doing that and by building their own consumer base, this is another thing. They're going that way. Now, having said that, what we see in America is an enormous budget deficit. Now, unless you see a sharp increase in savings, that is always reflected in a large trade deficit. Now, temporarily, we know that savings have increased in the sense that people have been locked down, money has been accumulating, and some of them also have been given money by the government into their bank accounts. So there is an increase in savings. But as soon as the lockdown ends and that passes, that money is going to be spent, or the majority of it's going to be spent. Right. And so the trade deficit with China is going to soar. But then we have another problem, which we haven't talked about and we haven't got time to talk about, I'm sure. And that is the supply chain disruption, which is just messing everything up.
Right. Well, we will have to leave it go at that. But if what I'm hearing you saying is a deteriorating financial situation in the United States, the massive amount of debasing of the currency is really what is going to undermine our hegemony, our power as America globally. And it's just sort of the Chinese have built up their wealth by producing things, and we've basically thrown our wealth away by consuming things and not saving. We are the consumers of the world. We sort of transferred wealth to China in that process, and now we're not in a very good footing, I guess. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's a reasonable assessment. There's so many more factors than that.
Of course.
But at the base, yes, that is what has happened.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being with us. Always a pleasure having you, and we'll look to do it again sometime soon, I hope. All right, folks, that's it for this week. Next week, David McIlvaney, Michael Oliver, and Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Firefox Gold is actively exploring in Finland, where recent discoveries have sparked a new gold rush. Firefox controls a major portion of a prospective gold belt, giving the company a distinct advantage for exploration and strategic partnerships. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, will put Firefox on the crest of the coming wave of gold discoveries. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.